Hi guys, welcome back to part two of episode 135 of Unknown Passage, a podcast that tells the stories of those who have gone missing or have been murdered abroad. I had a very fitful night's sleep. Obviously, things that are going on in the world are not ideal. I will not be getting into those because not everyone has to share their personal experiences or their opinions, and people should be comfortable with that. Just because they don't doesn't mean they don't care. Social media has become a bit of a scourge where people feel this pressure to share really personal experiences in order to, you know, be accepted by people in regards to current topics. And I'm just not going to go down that road, but it's terrible. But what I'm going to do is on this Saturday morning here in Australia, I'm going to try to take your mind off it with part two of a really terrible story. But it takes a lot of winding roads, so maybe it'll take your mind off things for an hour or so. But I also thought what I would do would be, if you are looking for something to distract you, just to get away from it all, during the last couple of years, I found a couple of YouTubes that did that for me, and they're both female-run travel YouTubes. And I was watching them the other day and like, oh, I don't know if I've ever talked about these two channels because I watch them just to escape from everything, one in particular. So that one is called Wonder Huzzy, W-O-N-D-H-U-S-S-Y. Her name's Sarah. She's American. She lives in Death Valley in the middle of nowhere, and her full-time job is just to go out. She's a YouTuber. She makes a lot of money actually through Patreon and through YouTube. And she's the most eccentric, awesome woman in probably late 30s. And she goes to the most out of the way, weird, desolate places in California, all up and down. She drives on her own. She goes there. I get really scared she's going to end up being an episode of this podcast at some point. But then again, she's real ballsy as well. She, Nevada, Montana, Arizona. I've learned so much from her podcast. She sleeps in random abandoned shacks in the middle of nowhere. It's just so relaxing because she's often just not online for so long, or she's just filming herself with no internet, you know, and she uploads it later and you're just really there. At the moment, she's doing like a hot springs tour of parts of Northern California, and it's just so cool. Like, so go and watch Wonder Huzzy, because she might take your mind off things. The other one is a girl called Celia Blomdahl. Now, she's Swedish, I believe, but she lives in a place called, she's got quite a lot of YouTube subscribers. Both these women have about 250,000. Cecilia I found through the Daily Mail randomly about a year or so ago. She lives in a place called Svalbard, which is in right at the top of Norway. Basically, it's not part of Norway. It's actually its own like independent place. It's the only visa-free place in the world. Anyone can move there. You don't need a visa. Heaps of downsides, like the fact that groceries cost about $2,000 a month because they only get a certain amount of shipments per month to the shop. Alcohol limits, things like that, because it's so isolated and so desolate that they only get a certain amount of deliveries via cargo on a ship. And it's dark for about 4 or 5 months of the year. That's how I found her. So when the sun was going down for like the last time for 5 months, the Daily Mail did an article on her and I found her and I just went through so many of her videos. And it's the opposite to Wonder Huzzy, who's often out in the desert when it's hot and things like that. Cecilia is like, you know, it's like minus 50 degrees. It's crazy. And she walks around. It's like 2 p.m. and it's pitch black. It's like it's midnight. And she's got this beautiful dog and she lives there with her partner and they've built this incredible hut and they get polar bears coming to their door. And it's just such an escape. So there's two recommendations for you to go and watch. Wonder Huzzy and Cecilia Blomdahl, B-L-O-M-D-A-H-L. And yeah, I hope that you enjoy them because they're both awesome YouTubers. And I don't like the term YouTubers. But these two chicks actually deserve the accolades. So We are back with part two of episode 135, and I just want to also welcome new patron Susan. Welcome on board. Where we left off, you have to listen to part one to have a background of these people. Bison Deli, born Brian Williams, was a, you know, very good NBA player who played for a number of different teams. He basically gave it all away at the age of 30. He changed his name to be more in line with his kind of ancestry, and he decided to retire from the NBA. He met a girl who seemingly was going to be the one to keep him on the straight and narrow and who he wanted to spend his life with. He bought a catamaran, and they had spent weeks and weeks sailing around the South Pacific, and he'd really fallen in love with French Polynesia in particular, and everything seemed idyllic, and that's where we left off in part one. But in part two, things will take quite a turn quite quickly. Very early correction in that first part. At one point I started talking about Wanda Hussey's podcast. I meant YouTube. Sorry, my brain's not really with it today. And I called Cecilia, even though I knew her name was Cecilia, it came out Celia at the start, and then it started morphing into Cecilia. So it is Cecilia Blomdahl. Cool. So this episode will kick off in a beautiful place far away from the mean streets of New York City where Serena Carlin was last living, and I guess Chicago, LA, Detroit, all the places that Bison Deli had been living in over the last few years during his NBA career. And we'll go to Tahiti, particularly an idyllic Tahitian island called Moorea. Now, the closest we've come to this area on this podcast, we have been to French Polynesia once before, to what's called the Marquesas Islands. It is a long way from this part of French Polynesia, this episode today. French Polynesia spans a huge part of the South Pacific. It is around 1,000 kilometres from the Marquesas Islands, where, if you remember, I don't remember what number episode it was, German Stefan Rahman was murdered on that island, if you remember that story. He was there with his girlfriend, also sailing, and they came across a not too nice local who ended up basically killing Stefan and hunting the girlfriend down, and then she survived, but basically the story evolved into crazy headlines about cannibalism and all this stuff that has never been proven. But that did have some sort of closure. And I'm going to try to stop using the word closure. Who was it recently who I was listening to and they used a better word? That'll come to me. So Tahiti is the largest island in French Polynesia in the South Pacific. French Polynesia is divided into groups of archipelagos, which I've talked about on the Stefan Rahman episode. The Marquesas Islands, where Stefan Rahman was murdered, as I said, is 1,000 kilometres from the Society Islands of French Polynesia, which is where Tahiti falls into. Tahiti is closer kind of to Australia. I think it's about an 8-hour flight, which actually isn't a lot when you're Australian. So the same group, which is the Society Islands of French Polynesia that Tahiti is in, also includes Bora Bora, which a lot of you will know. It's very kind of Instagrammable. I fucking cringe at myself just saying that. But I mean, before the Kardashians went there and Kim lost her fucking earring, people went to Bora Bora, but it's become insanely popular, insanely expensive. It always has been. But Moorea, which is where we'll go today to kick things off, is actually just as beautiful, but a lot cheaper, way less tourists. And they say you should go there instead. French is the official language across the islands. It is a French colony. And if you're kind of a fan of art, you'll know that Paul Gauguin, who was a famous French painter, kind of at the turn of the century, not this turn of the century, the one before, he moved to probably around like 1920, he moved to Tahiti, for inspiration, and he ended up being famous for painting the local Polynesians of the islands. You can see a lot of his work on display in Paris. Tahiti is very similar kind of in cultural dress and vibe. It has a lot of links to Hawaii, and a lot of people see similarities between the two. French Polynesia actually has 118 islands, and as I said, other highlights include Bora Bora, but a lot of people think that Vanuatu and New Caledonia falls into French Polynesia, and it doesn't. And French New Caledonia is the closest that I have come to traveling to this part of the world, but they are French islands. The island is shaped like a figure eight, and so there's two parts of the island. And the bottom part of the eight, which is called Tahiti Nui, is the larger section that most tourists go to. And then the top part of the figure eight is Tahiti Iti, which is the eastern, more kind of remote peninsula. It spans over 1,000 kilometres squared, Tahiti, and it's home to around 200,000 people, which are known as Tahitians. They do speak French, but actually Tahitian is a language that is spoken. They have their own language, and English is a third language that they speak there. And a lot of people do, because of tourism, Tahiti's always been very popular. And you can fly there with Air Tahiti. And I think that's the only airline. You have to fly to New Zealand and then fly on to Tahiti. Maybe Qantas goes direct there. Not sure. My days of working in a travel agency when they were a thing is a long time ago. Now, Tahiti's capital is a place called, when I worked in a travel agency, we said Papeete, but they also pronounce it Papeete. So I'm just going to say Papeete. That is the capital of Tahiti, and they consider it the only real city of French Polynesia. Here, this is where you'd go to properly stock up on supplies, as a lot of people here are on their boats or catamarans, like Bison and Serena were, or to spend some time in a city on land, because you're not going to get that on other islands in the French Polynesia cities. The nearby island of very close to Tahiti Nui is the island of Moorea. Moorea is really magical. It's spelled M-O-O-R-E-A. And you can see from photos just why Bison fell in love with it immediately and why he and Serena ended up spending so much time there. The locals call Moorea the magical island. And it has, I don't know why people go to Bora Bora, because it just, it's so much less crowded, Moorea, but it has everything that you would want. And it looks very similar as well, except it's got volcanoes and this really rugged interior. And they kind of compare it to the Hawaiian island of Kauai. Is that how you say it? I've always seen it. I never really say it. Moorea is home to around 16,000 people. And it spans about 134 square kilometres. It's just 10 nautical miles from Tahiti Nui, and you can get a ferry. It takes around 50 to 60 minutes, or you can even fly between the two, and that takes about 15 minutes. Some people commute between the two for work. According to Tahiti.com, quote, "The attraction towards Moorea comes as no surprise. The island is a geographical marvel. Eight voluminous mountain peaks rise from its translucent lagoon, creating a distinctive and rugged silhouette visible from the western coast of Tahiti. Splitting the northern shore are two symmetrical bays, Cook's and Opanohu Bay. The island is roughly shaped like a heart from overhead, and in the theme of love and romance, Moorea is one of the top honeymoon destinations in Tahiti, second only to Bora Bora. Moorea is the pride and joy of French Polynesia. She may be considered Tahiti's little sister, but she steals a spotlight every time. The island is a true reflection of laid-back Tahitian lifestyle and the warm, welcoming character of French Polynesia and its people," unquote. Moorea is now home to a range of high-end resorts, although it hasn't completely been overtaken by them like Bora Bora has. This includes the Sofitel, which is still there, which Bison and Serena would stay at and be fans of, and comes into play at the beginning of part two. Reviews state that Bora Bora is the more ostentatious and pretentious version of Maria and to opt for Maria instead. So now on to Serena and Bison. When Serena flew back to join Bison on his 50-foot catamaran for good this time, the two found themselves on the island of Maria, flitting between staying in picturesque overwater bungalows, pretty much identical to what you see in Bora Bora, to staying at the Sofitel Resort on Maria, which is one of the top-rated high-end resorts on Maria or even Tahiti as a whole. Sports Illustrated in 2013 spoke to a local man who once worked at the Sofitel called Big Charlie. In 2002, he worked at the Sofitel, and 11 years on when he was being interviewed, he remembered the two well. Bison was kind and gentle. Serena was really beautiful. The two tore around the island on a red scooter, which is how people get around these islands. Bison would be driving and he'd be sitting, you know, because he's such a 6'11" on a red scooter. And Serena would be sitting between his legs at the front, like on the seat in front of him. And he would be, you know, steering. Big Charlie told Sports Illustrated that you could feel the love that they had for each other. And then he stopped and he said, quote, "It was sad what happened," unquote. Charlie introduced Chris Bellard of Sports Illustrated to a man called Teva, which he's a lifelong local who once upon a time also worked at the Sofitel. He, by this point in 2013, was living this semi-off-grid lifestyle on a remote part of Maria, and he was quite hard to track down for Chris Bellard. He ended up being told not to look for him and call him Teva, to ask locals where Ure lived, U-R-E. And Chris found out pretty soon not to say that to women, local women, that it was a nickname that the men on the island had for Teva. And then definition is the penis, which when Teva talks about himself in the article, you realise why. That's all I'm saying. Teva is finally tracked down by Sports Illustrated. He's a French-speaking island hippie who considers himself, quote, a hunter of women. Now, that's kind of like a bad, because he doesn't speak English as his first language. He's just like a womanizer, really. He's not hunting women on the island, like the most dangerous game or something. He once worked at the Sofitel, and he tries to get money out of Chris for his version of events or his story or his recollections about Bison and Serena, but because you can't pay for stories, he finally relents because he just wants someone to listen to him talk. So he tells Chris that he spent a good month with the two and that Bison was kind and generous and that the two were really happy. He talked about how at one stage Bison started really inquiring about buying properties on the island and staying there permanently. And he told Teva to inquire with him with local real estate agents about three particular properties for sale on the island that he liked. He wanted to buy one for himself, one for him and Serena, one for his mum, and one for Teva. And Teva said he just couldn't believe it, you know, that this guy was offering to buy him a house, because this Teva couldn't have had much money, and he's working at the Sofitel and he was working, you know, all the time as well. Serena had been back with Bison for a couple of months when around June of 2002, Bison's troubled brother Miles suddenly made an appearance in Tahiti. He was actually in New Zealand, which is where you fly to from the States to get to Tahiti, and you fly there first. And he just turned up unannounced in New Zealand and contacted Bison and said, "I'm in New Zealand and I want to come see you." Now, there is one article from, I believe it's sportscasting.com, but also the New Zealand Herald did quite a lot of coverage of this, and it made me question whether or not he'd been on the catamaran before, and I kind of think he had. Now, this article was from the New Zealand Herald in 2003, and it talked about how around January, I believe probably when Serena had gone home for a bit, Miles had come out to see Bison and they'd argued the whole time and Miles had gone home and this time he was back again. Now, I can't get clarification on which way it is, whether he'd been out or whether this was his first time, but I actually kind of think that he'd been out before, and I'll get into why I think that later. Instantly, Serena, who took most people for who they were, got bad vibes off of Bison, off of Miles, and she would call her friend, her best friend, Steele, a guy who lived back in the States. And Steele would tell Sports Illustrated that although Serena never spoke badly of anyone, she did of Miles. She just said she had a bad feeling. And, you know, that's that gut instinct that you just can't ignore and you shouldn't ignore. The captain of the catamaran, who is our third victim in this story, was a hired local called Bernard Seldo. Now, what's really sad is that when you search for him, there's just nothing. All you know is he was born in 1970. He was around 32 when this happened. He was French. Whether or not he was a French expat who'd moved to Tahiti or whether he was actually born on Tahiti, I have no idea. No one ever talks about Bernard and it's really sad. Sadly, that's all we know about him. But one thing I do know about Bernard from some sources that repeat this and regurgitate it in kind of one-liners is that Bernard Seldo found Miles DeBoard strange, quote unquote. Tiva too had a bad feeling about Miles when he arrived. And all of these people, you know, had these bad feelings. But I mean, what are you going to do? I get bad feelings about a lot of people and I don't think they're murderers. But it just shows that somebody's bad negative energy really exudes from them. And people can really feel that. You know, we do have a sixth sense, I've always believed, when it comes to these things. And he told Sports Illustrated years later that Miles DeBoard, quote, wasn't nice. So basically he had been hanging around, Tiva had, with Bison and Serena for about a month on the island in between working at the Sofitel, and they would drink on the beach and go out on the boat, and they got really tight with him. And then Miles turned up and Tiva said, quote, he was busy in the head, he was strange, but Brian loved his brother. The brother never talked. I feel it. Something was wrong. Brian was positive and this guy was negative, unquote. And we talked about their upbringings and kind of how their life trajectories went different directions. But I'm not making excuses for that on this episode. On the morning of July 6, 2002, the group of four, Bison, Serena, Bernard Seldo, the captain of the catamaran, and Miles set off for a trip. This would take them from basically Maria, they would go to the Tahitian capital of Papeete, or Papeete or Papiti, to the island of Raiatea, which is around a 20-hour journey away. And from there, after staying there for a bit, they would cross the Pacific to Hawaii and explore the islands of Hawaii. Now, whether Bison was serious about buying property on Maria, if he was leaving already, I'm not entirely sure. Maybe he intended on returning. Maybe they were just kind of out to explore for a month or two and then to come back. We just don't know. So Bison had asked Tiva to come along on this trip to be the fifth person. And Tiva just couldn't believe his luck. This guy's offering to buy him a house and now he's offering him this cool trip to Hawaii, and he'd never left Tahiti. So he went to his boss at the Sofitel. He'd probably worked there for years, probably never got given time off, who knows. His boss wouldn't let him have time off, so he couldn't go. So all he could do was, you know, wave them off. Then over the next 2 days after the group left, the catamaran satellite phone was used four times by those on board. I don't know the details of these, but it was most likely Bernard Seldo to other boats and things like that. None of these calls were distress calls. They were perfectly normal. And then the catamaran, the Hakuna Matata, went quiet. Weeks went by with no communication from the two and no one really thought it was strange. This was 2002. We didn't have social media. they were regularly kind of not in communication because they were on deserted islands, you know, or remote islands in the South Pacific. And this is a 30 and a 33-year-old, you know. I also was thinking there's not really anyone in Miles or Bison's family that would have raised the alarm. They were estranged from both their parents. Both of them were. Dad was a dead loss, as we established in part one, which is sad, but hold on to your hats because mum's going to be worse soon. And I mean, it would have been Serena Carlin's family, and they really picked up the slack, I believe. And I believe in the end, it was probably them who, in late August 2002, around 6 weeks after they were last heard from, they raised the alarm with the US Coast Guard, as they were really panicked by this point. The US Coast Guard issued a bulletin, a distress bulletin, in late August to all ships within a 1,000-mile radius of Tahiti to look out for the Hakuna Matata. It was a, you know, not ostentatious, but it was a big 50-foot-long catamaran, white, brand new, beautiful, and it shouldn't have just disappeared off the face of the earth. Kevin Porter was living in Detroit still, and he was still managing Bison's affairs from his home, and he was holding out hope that his friend was still alive. He couldn't for years believe that his friend could be dead because he was so full of life. So he was just kind of trying to hold down the fort and manage his financial affairs and everything else in the absence of the friend. Now, Serena's stepdad, Scott, was a total legend. He set up basically an epicenter at their home with a website and phones, and he put together this huge dossier of what he knew about their movements. And he tried to get the FBI and the White House to help, but it wouldn't be, it would be a couple of weeks later that the FBI would finally get involved. On September 5th, 2002, almost exactly 2 months after the catamaran left Tahiti, a man walked into a gold dealer in the Arizona capital of Phoenix. Is it the capital? Could be somewhere weird. Named Certified Mint Incorporated. That is the name of the gold dealer. Yep, Phoenix is the capital. On we go. A world away from the remote French Polynesian island. It was 1:30 in the afternoon on September 5th, 2002, and this man said that he wanted to buy for a 461-ounce gold eagle coins, which equaled a value of around $152,000. Obviously, you need to produce identification in order to do this. And he produced a passport and checkbook to prove his identity. And this passport and checkbook were both in the name of Bison Daly. Now, a lot of people put a lot of emphasis on the gold coin thing and why this person, which is Miles DeBoard, was wanting to buy gold. And I'm not really going to focus on that. A, because I'm not an expert in gold. B, I think it's pretty probably straightforward in regards to maybe it being less traceable, but I think it's not at the forefront of what people should be worried about. Basically, luckily, Kevin Porter had an alert from banks should any movement be made using Bison's information and his money, because his checkbook is linked to his bank account. A checkbook, for those of you who are probably under 25, was basically a thing that you had to use in order to deposit money and withdraw money. Look it up. Kevin basically got an alert saying that this man had come into this certified mint dealership wanting to buy gold, and seems very strange. He immediately contacted the Phoenix Police Department. They went down there and the man was quickly apprehended. That man clearly was not Bison Daly. It was Miles DeBoard, his troubled brother. Miles was interrogated for about 5 hours by the Phoenix Police Department, and his story to them was that he was buying the gold using Bison's money, for Bison, who was totally fine the last time he had heard from him. He did not explain why he was in Arizona or where Bison was, just that he was out doing his thing on his catamaran. And somehow, because the Phoenix Police Department were not able to make contact with Bison Deli in any way to confirm or deny this, Miles was allowed to leave the Phoenix Police Department. By this point, though, Kevin Porter had flown down from Detroit immediately to Phoenix. And people say, especially Patrick Byrne, would have a lot of issue with Kevin Porter. And I do understand that, like, later on. But I think he, in this instance, had Bison's best interests at heart, Bison and Serena. He'd introduced Bison to Serena many years before, as we talked about on part one. And the speed he got down there, because I think he knew that this guy was going to be let go, and he just wanted to get answers as to where his friend was. And according to the ESPN article that I talked about on part one, basically when Phoenix Police Department let Miles to board go, Kevin Porter had got there in time, thankfully, in a way. And they checked into the Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport Hotel, and they sat there for 10 hours that night with Kevin Porter basically interrogating Miles himself, saying, "What the fuck's going on? Where is your brother?" And basically wouldn't let him go to sleep or go anywhere. They refer to him, again, as a burly fireplug of a man. This went on all night, and eventually at around 5 a.m., Kevin Porter and Miles DeBoard started having what they refer to as a scuffle, and Kevin grabbed Miles by the neck, which must be a pretty big feat considering he's 6'8". And he screamed at him, "You have to tell me something now. Where are they?" According to him, Miles said back to him, "Come to Mexico with me." When Kevin Porter asked him why, apparently Miles DeBoard told him, quote, "We're in a state that carries the death penalty. I'm flying to a state, California, that carries the death penalty. In order for me to tell you anything, I have to be in Mexico," unquote. Kevin Porter's mind was just whizzing. He didn't know what the hell was going on. But as the investigation kind of went on and the FBI got involved, because this was spanning, you know, state lines at this point, the pieces began to fall into place. And they were able to retrospectively, you know, look back and look at things through cooperation with the Tahitian police, things that had happened not long after the four had set sail from the island of Moria. So 2 months before, on July 8th, 2 days after the Hakuna Matata left the island of Moria, a man that for the most part mostly resembled Bison Deli booked into the Pearl Resort on the island of Moria, the island that Bison and Serena had loved so much, and where he had made friends with Big Charlie and Tiva and all of these locals. This man was joined by his girlfriend, who had flown in from LA to meet him. Her name was Erica. She did not match Serena's description at all. These two lived it up, they swam, they ate well, and they drank cocktails. And this was Miles DeBoard and his girlfriend Erica, who he flew in from LA, seemingly when three other people had just vanished off the face of the earth. 8 days later, after this little trip to a really nice resort on Moria was done, on July 16th, 2002, a catamaran that kind of looked like the Hakuna Matata was sailed into a small bay on the southeastern shore of Tahiti by the same man, Miles DeBoard, except this catamaran was damaged along its hull. And one of the confusing things is when it, no one ever mentions that it was repainted, but when you look up pictures, you have this amazing white catamaran, brand new, as it was when Bison purchased it. And then you've got these kind of pictures of this dodgy catamaran with this blue hull. and really bad paint job, and it's damaged. And I thought that people were uploading the wrong pictures, but it turns out that that's the before and after. The catamaran had been repainted very dodgily, and I don't know by who, and it was damaged because it was clearly being sailed by someone who had no experience in captaining a catamaran or any kind of boat. The boat also had the name the Aria Bella added to it, painted on it, but the outline of its original name, which had once been spelt out in vinyl decals along its stern, was still visible because of the sticky stuff underneath it. And this very clearly said the Hakuna Matata. Now, this reminds me of an episode we've done before, and if anyone can remind me which one, or maybe it's just a case, I know it just eerily reminds me of something, or maybe it's a movie, maybe I'm thinking of Dead Calm. I don't know. Miles de Bourgh stored the boat in this little bay, and at this point, it wouldn't be tracked for almost 2 months by the time the FBI got involved and located it. And he then left and first flew back to LA from Papeete, Tahiti, and then very quickly after, he flew onwards to Belize for about a month or more. Then, after a time in Belize, which no one specifies what he did there, he then travelled back to the United States. His girlfriend had since returned to her home in Northern California, and he returned to Phoenix, Arizona, which no one ever specifies either. And you'll find out why we can't really get answers as to all of these strange choices that Miles is making and these weird flights he's taking and itineraries and things like that. Unfortunately, the grave error of releasing Miles de Bourgh by Phoenix PD after he'd been arrested for trying to use Bison Deli's passport and checkbook to buy gold was just that. It was a grave error that they could never undo. After his fitful night's sleep and scuffle with Kevin Porter at the airport hotel, Miles flew back to Northern California to his girlfriend Erica's house. Then, after being there for barely a few hours, he then flew down to Mexico, just as Kevin Porter had said he planned to do. Finally, after almost 3 months, or sorry, finally, after 2 months of Miles, Bernard, and Serena not being heard from, and all of this spanning so many different countries, cities, and states, the FBI finally got involved. From Mexico, Miles contacted his estranged mother, Patricia. He told her, "Mum, you know me, I couldn't survive prison," unquote. By now, Patrick Byrne, the one that I talked about on part one, the other one of Bison's really good friends for a long time, and they'd really bonded over their love of adventure sports and things like that. And I believe that he's a really, really good friend, and had Bison's real best interests at heart. He became involved. Patrick had money. He was a rich kid growing up. He makes no qualms about that. He, had made a lot of money in his business and he could talk. Kevin Porter put him in touch with Miles de Bourgh through Miles's mother, who had his phone number down in Mexico. Basically, Patrick Byrne said he said on the phone to Miles he would do anything to try to get answers, and he said what he had to say to try to get Miles on board with him. He said he could help Miles, that he would give him money, that he would understand whatever he told him, that he would bring him $150,000 cash to Mexico if that's the amount that he needed, because he was trying to buy that gold for that amount. So it was all set up, and Patrick went down to a small border town in Mexico. He basically crossed over the border on foot that he believed Miles de Bourgh to be in. Miles stood out 6'8". He felt like he could find him. As he searched for Miles de Bourgh in this small Mexican border town, his phone rang. It was the Phoenix Police Department, and they were relaying to Patrick Byrne the new information that almost 2 months after being stored in a small inlet in Tahiti, the damaged boat had been located. Patrick Byrne said that until this point he had held out hope that Bison was out there somewhere, but in this moment he knew that he was in fact dead. Patrick Byrne told a story that I just shook my head at. And I believe everything he says, and I believe that he makes no qualms about the fact that Bison just didn't have good parents. I don't know how else to put it. He just had two selfish parents, and I'm not afraid to say that. Two self-involved, selfish parents. And there, someone who studied psychology out there, there's so much that you could read into about how Miles and Bison ended up and how their parents were. It's unbelievable. So you may remember on the first episode how Bison had bought his dad a Harley Davidson as this surprise, and his dad had looked at it, turned to Bison and said, "Son, next time just give me the cash." If you think that's bad, hold on. So once finding out about the ship, the boat being found, Patrick Byrne decided to call Patricia Phillips, Bison and Miles's mother, and he told her what had just been relayed to him. He said there was a long pause, and finally Patricia, mother of one missing son and one currently in Mexico, whereabouts kind of unknown, she said to Patrick Byrne, quote, "You know, Patrick, he never bought me anything." Patrick said he was stunned. He said to her, Patricia, "I thought he paid for you to go to UCLA, and he told me he bought you a house for $350,000. And she replied to Patrick Byrne, quote, "Patrick, I've met other NBA mums who wear more than that on their wrist," unquote. Now, Patricia doesn't deny saying that. I don't even know if she's still alive. She said it was taken out of context. I do not believe for a second. I believe Patrick Byrne bore witness to these excuses for parents. And that's why for such a long time he was so anti-press, anti-Bison's family. He was just sickened by the whole thing. And personally, so am I. I know in the end she got whatever she wanted to put on her wrist. And we'll get into that shortly. Unfortunately, Patrick Byrne down in Mexico never located Miles in that border town. And around this time, America's Most Wanted ran a segment on Miles DeBord. That brings us to September 15th, 10 days after Miles DeBord walked into that Phoenix gold dealer and was apprehended by police. A patient was brought to a hospital in Chula Vista, California. And he was described in his intake form as being, quote, "found down in Mexico," unquote. He'd been transferred from Mexican hospital, basically brain dead, once he was identified as an American and returned to an American hospital. The 6'8" African-American man had been found on a Mexican beach, and he had overdosed on insulin. He was taken to a local hospital until he could be transferred back to the States. He was seemingly brain dead, no reflexes, no responses from pupils, anything like that. They do a lot of testing to determine this kind of stuff. There's actually a very controversial case going on in the UK at the minute. A little boy who hung himself because of TikTok, some TikTok trend, and he's brain dead, and it just recently went to a judge to determine that his life support should be turned off, and the parents are fighting it. They believe he's not brain dead, but the doctors say that he is, and they have to do a battery of tests over a period of time to determine that, and it's usually brainstem death, and if there's no reflexes, there's no brainstem movement, and you can't survive like on your own. You need reflexes to be able to cough and things like that. That's why you put on like a ventilator when you're under general anesthetic, just to make sure, because it just dulls your reflexes. But the insulin overdose is, it made me think of the movie Reversal of Fortune, if you've ever seen that, with Jeremy Irons and Glenn Close. And I actually rewatched that recently. It's about Sonny Von Bülow, and I believe she was kept alive on life support for like decades. It was crazy. But she, I believe it was an insulin overdose, and whether or not her husband did it is up for kind of speculation. But insulin is a surefire way of doing that, if that's kind of what you want to do, an insulin overdose. And not giving anyone advice. I just know that it's pretty rapid. according to this person's hospital emergency record, quote, the patient had areas on the right buttock and both wrists of blistering, suggesting that he had been down and not moving for a significant period of time, unquote. So they don't go into detail about that, but I think it's that lividity where the blood settles after you've been in a particular position for a certain amount of time. And the fact that he had been laying on his back on a beach for a while before being found, I think, lends itself to that. 11 days later, this patient was taken off life support. This patient was Miles DeBoard. He died the next day. His death certificate read his cause of death as, quote, suicide attempt with hypoglycemic brain damage with subsequent discontinuation of life support, unquote. Kevin Williams, who later became Miles DeBoard, had used up all avenues. He had nowhere else to go, and I think he was cornered like an animal. And he laid on a beach. He overdosed on insulin that he'd been able to get his hands on. He laid down to die on that Mexican beach. And when he was found, he was brain dead. He had given a series of stories to his girlfriend Erica to justify his actions right before he flew down to Mexico. And I get angry when I read these because they're so ridiculous. And the coverage of them, I understand why Patrick Byrne gets so mad every time he hears someone regurgitating Miles DeBoard's version of events, because it just breathes new life into the story of a pathological liar, basically. But in the interests of covering it all, I'll briefly go through it now. He had told his girlfriend that barely 24 hours after setting off from Tahiti, Bison and himself had gotten into a fight on the catamaran. Now, during this, Bison, according to Miles, had accidentally punched his girlfriend Serena in the face. She fell backwards, hit her head on something that was made of steel, and instantly died. Then Bernard Seldo, the captain, had come out and said, we have to report her death, so we have to go back to shore. And Bison apparently grabbed a wrench and beat Bernard Seldo to death, killing him. And then Miles, who was eternally the victim in every story of his life, decided to grab the gun that was kept on board and shot his brother in order to defend himself from dying. He then anchored the three bodies down with gym equipment, dumbbells, and threw them into the Pacific, never to be found, despite the fact that, according to him, two of them had been killed by Bison and one was him, and it was self-defense. Now, if you buy that, you need help. And I'll back up why. The FBI determined very quickly that forensically this story was completely impossible and that Miles DeBoard was completely full of shit, and that is obvious. It did not happen this way, and forensics prove this. The FBI flew out to Tahiti and did extensive testing on the Hakuna Matata. There was not blood where Miles DeBoard said any of this happened. People being shot, people being bashed with wrenches, you know, people hitting their head on things where there should have been to match his story. He honestly, I don't think, thought far enough ahead to think that they'd be able to prove that it was a lie. The state of the catamaran told an entirely different story. There was no bullet holes, even though he said he fired at Bison to save his own life anywhere. A female FBI investigator, so what they call them, FBI agent, Elizabeth Castaneda, she headed a huge, you know, dual country FBI investigation that spanned the USA, Tahiti, even Belize, where at one point after he fled, Miles went down to, and she knows the deal. Her belief is that Miles DeBoard was inherently jealous of his brother, and jealousy was the root of it all. It was a typical modern day Cain and Abel story. She believes that Miles, based on the evidence that she has accrued over, you know, an investigation that was very thorough, that he forced the three, Bison, Serena and Bernard, at gunpoint into the water, which is a terrible thought. This was premeditated. that he had anchored them with bodybuilding weights that had been purchased, and then he threw them into the water. And if you've ever watched anything about that Oba Chandler, that terrible piece of shit down in Florida that killed that mother and her two daughters who were on a trip because the daughter had been molested, and they wanted to take the daughter on a holiday to get her mind off things, and they came up against a serial killer. There is an amazing Forensic Files episode on it. They finally got him through his handwriting. It's a amazing police work, but he did that to that family of three. And it also reminded me of the Tom and Jackie Hawkes case, which I hate. I hate even thinking about it. They were a couple who sold their yacht because one of their kids was expecting a baby and they wanted to be around instead of traveling on the yacht for, they wanted to be there for their grandchild. So they sold the yacht, unfortunately, to a man who was a psychopath, and him and his friends, when they took them out on the yacht to test it, threw Tom and Jackie Hawkes while they were alive off the boat anchored, and they were just a lovely older couple, and I didn't even have to look up their names because that story just affects me so much. It's always been there in the back of my mind. So one of the things I found really interesting was that I found the New Zealand Herald article from 2003 that talked about these bodybuilding weights and how they came into the possession of the boat, because I thought, oh, Bison probably had workout equipment on his catamaran. But within this article with the New Zealand Herald, it said that they were purchased in Auckland, these bodybuilding weights, Auckland, New Zealand, and that they were sold at a Rebel Sport, which is an Australian New Zealand brand of sporting equipment store. And that in earlier that year, or right around the time that Miles flew into New Zealand to meet, you know, Bison and Serena for the fateful trip, Bison and his brother had gone shopping at Rebel Sport, and they'd gone in together, and everyone who worked there remembered them because they were like, well, you know, Kiwis or Aussies would be like, whoa, if they saw a 6'8" guy and a 6'11" guy, African-Americans stand out with their American accents, and you'd automatically go, they must play basketball or they must be NBA players or something like that. So no one ever forgot them. And they'd gone in and looked at these bodybuilding weights together. And then later on, Miles came back and bought them, but he was on his own. And just the way it was written indicated that either you can take it one of two ways, that they wanted workout equipment on the ship to work out because they wouldn't be able to get off it for a while as they crossed the Pacific, which is fair enough. I may believe that. I'm not sure. Or Miles DeBoard was buying them for a purpose, and depending on how you want to look at it. Teva, the Sofitel employee back on Maria, has his own theory about what happens, although he, like most rational people, believes that Miles DeBoard, you know, did this on purpose. He believes, based on what he saw and the interactions that he saw between Miles and Serena, that Miles was obsessed with Serena. And I read into this a lot, because if you look at what Serena said to her friend Steele when she rang back home, she said she felt really uncomfortable with him. And maybe he was putting off, you know, pervy vibes or just discomfort, you know, like that feeling, like lecherous vibes. I don't know how else to put it. And that's probably what she was referring to. So maybe Teva picked up on that energy. He believed that when he spoke to Sports Illustrated in 2013, and he believed that Miles basically intended to kill the others to either abduct Serena for a time or to do something to her, and that somewhere along the line something went wrong and that Bison had overpowered Miles. So, you know, he'd killed Bison. Now, that made me think this could have gone any number of ways. We know that there was about 2 days between them leaving the island until all communications stopped. I hate the thought that maybe Serena was kept for a while, but it seems that Miles didn't waste any time contacting his girlfriend to fly her out for an all-expenses-paid trip. by the way, according to ESPN, at no point did she ask where the others were while she was out there on the catamaran. At no point did she say, what happened to your brother? Anything like that. Just no questions. Just, yeah, free holiday. So I hate the thought that maybe Serena didn't die first. That's a terrible thought. And then he'd done something terrible to her while Bison and Bernard were already dead. And we don't know the order that this went in. But I do trust the FBI, what they said through their investigation. And Elizabeth Castaneda believes that they were all killed together at the same time. Whether that is because Miles wanted to steal the catamaran or he just wanted to watch them die because years of being jealous of his younger brother had finally built up. But by the time he was 35, he was dead. And his brother, he killed his little brother. And if you look at pictures of them when they were little boys, I put a couple on, the website, but also in Patreon. They're just so sweet and look like best mates, you know. They look like twins. And it's just tragic what envy or jealousy in this instance does to people. What we do know, however, and I guess it's up to you to fill in the gap because even the Tahitian investigators have no idea what happened. What we do know is that however it went down, Miles DeBoard killed his brother, his brother's partner, and the boat's captain on board, which makes him like a mass murderer. And no matter how much you think he hated his brother or whatever, it doesn't excuse anything. And it doesn't excuse the killing of two other people either. He then anchored them down and threw them into the ocean to basically be fish food. He had used his dead brother's money afterwards to live large with his girlfriend to fly her out to Tahiti. He couldn't sail a catamaran, so he damaged his brother's beloved boat, had it really shoddily repainted, and then he damaged it trying to pilot it. He then stored it. He flew to Belize to hide via the States. And I believe that when the money ran out there that he'd probably withdrawn from Bison's account, he devised a plan to get more money in the form of a less trackable method, which was gold. His hubris did not allow him to think he would be caught or that Bison had friends who wouldn't allow this to happen. And when he ran out of options, he went down to Mexico and he killed himself because he felt cornered. And I think that's exactly what happened. Sorry, guys. I know I said that I would cheer you up, but I just realized this is not the episode for it. I am planning on doing a funny episode at some point that I've got planned, hopefully in the near future. For some reason, the next thing is not going to make you much happier. But for some reason, the brothers whose funeral was organised for a fortnight later in LA by their mother, they had a joint funeral, which I actually found more offensive than maybe anything in the whole story. But mummy's got to get a... She's got to get her, you know, expensive stuff on her wrist, remember? In 2013, when Sports Illustrated tracked down Patrick Byrne, he was battling cancer again. He was sick and he was sick of the coverage of Miles DeBoard and his bullshit story of supposed self-defense. And as a result, he did not do press until Sports Illustrated contacted him and did their incredible, massive article on this. And you know what? I'm sick of it too, just in case you can't tell. I hate coverage of it that kind of tries to pick apart the minds of these people and why they were the way they were. At the end of the day, he was, I think, just he was shallow. He was not motivated at all. And you have to motivate yourself. You have to get beyond things. You have to find your inner kind of will. It all falls on you at the end of the day. It's not onto anyone else. And people do amazing things from very little. And Miles DeBoard did not have very little. He was given so much by his brother. He was given so much money that he could have used to kickstart an incredible business or to do good for the rest of the world or to go live somewhere cheap. Go back to Africa, like to see, you know, you're so interested in your ancestors and that's where you get your surname from. So go to Nigeria and work with the underprivileged there. But there was never a thought with Miles DeBoard that that's what should be done. It's always just kind of like me and it's going to get really bad. Patrick Byrne was a really good friend. He was a real one. And I'm so glad that Bison had that in lieu of such a poor family that he didn't have any choice of being born into. And one of the saddest things for Patrick Byrne was he still had access to, you know, witness a lot of Bison's bank accounts. And very quickly after Bison was declared dead, and the brothers were, you know, had their joint funeral and Miles was put in the ground, Patrick Byrne witnessed Bison's hard-earned money from the NBA, which was going to keep Bison and Serena basically for the rest of their lives, disappear from the bank accounts until within a couple of years they were bone dry, the bank accounts. Mummy finally got her expensive watch for her wrist, and Daddy probably got the cash he wanted because he didn't want the Harley. He said, just give me the cash. And there was soon nothing left at all, according to Patrick Byrne. Patricia, Bison's mum, openly says everyone's a liar. Patrick Byrne's a liar. Kevin Porter's a liar. The FBI are liars. The police are liars in Phoenix, everywhere else. In Tahiti, they're liars. Hosseini, Bison's really good friend that he would regularly visit in Lebanon, is a liar. Serena's parents are liars. Everyone is a liar except for Patricia. The mother who was estranged from her only two children for years because neither of them could tolerate her. And I wonder how and where Miles got his victim mentality from. Patrick told Sports Illustrated, quote, I've been waiting 10 years for someone to ask about his life, not his death. About singular moments, adventures shared, unbreakable connections. You can feel the love. Patrick feels his own mortality now and he cannot tell the stories fast enough. He wants people to know who Brian was and how special he was, unquote. And that's why I just want to, you know, I don't like people covering these stories for TikTok in 5 minutes because these are people with whole stories. And that's why sometimes I do two or three or four parters, like with Sean Flynn. You know, these people's lives are so fascinating. And when you talk to anyone, when you're traveling, you can find out, you can just meet the most nondescript person and they've had the most insane experiences. And I think that's so important. And that's, I understand why Patrick Byrne was just burnt out by the press. No one ever asked about Bison's life. And to this day, no one does. If you search for him, it's just these clickbaity titles about going missing. There's nothing of substance in articles about his life before. Kudos, the only ones that have really done extensive ones are sports-related magazines like ESPN, Sports Illustrated, NBA Insider. But yeah. In 2013, Patrick Byrne got an out of the blue phone call from Kevin Porter. Kevin Porter wanted money because he'd written a Hollywood screenplay about Bison's life, and he asked Patrick Byrne, who he hadn't spoken to for years, for money to finance it. Patrick Byrne, being who he is, completely lost it and told Kevin Porter to never contact him again, and that's why they had such a big rift, but that had gone back for years, even before Bison went missing. Patrick did not trust Kevin Porter. So the jury's out on that. But both men do agree on one thing I find interesting. Both said, Kevin Porter in his ESPN interview and Patrick Byrne in his Sports Illustrated interview, both said the same thing, which I find weird. They both said that around the time he went missing, Bison was planning a return to the NBA, which I find really strange because none of his movements or actions were indicating that. And his whole life in the NBA seemed to be a square peg in a round hole. He couldn't wait to get out, it seems like. And he hadn't been out for that long. So was it the money? Was he running out of money? Had he given people too much money? Or did he not find the peace that he thought he would on his catamaran? I find that really interesting. And I think it's probably true because both men say that and both of these men do not get along with each other. The Tahitian authorities obviously have no way of knowing what happened or where the bodies are. And honestly, according to Sports Illustrated, they aren't hugely interested and wouldn't even reply to phone calls from Sports Illustrated for the article that they wrote. The website set up by Serena's stepdad to find answers that was live for years. It was called whereisbison.com is long shut down. It doesn't exist anymore. I'm not even sure if Serena's parents are even still alive. So they were in their 70s at the time the Sports Illustrated article was written 9 years ago. Serena today would be 50 and Bison would be 53 if they were still alive, which is crazy to think about. I don't know if Bison's mother, Patricia, is still alive either. But Serena's parents still keep in touch with Serena's many friends that loved her so much. And her mum, Gail, said that it took a decade for her to even be able to talk about Serena. That's why in the early ESPN interview that they did in 2003, she's not talking about her. The stepdad does all the talking because the pain was just too palpable. She was pretty much blocking it out to be able to function. She sees many signs, you know, every day. She believes a Serena sending her signs, and she has a really good outlook on where the couple was in their mindsets when they died, which is interesting considering she never met Bison. She said, or Gail, Serena's mum, said, quote, "I think they shared this sort of vast yearning for understanding the bigger picture of life and being connected to energy somehow. Brian had this enormous desire to break the chains of familial dysfunction and to be free of that. I think that somehow this was something that they were working on together," unquote. Now, again, Gail never even met Bison, and she speaks more like a mother who tried to understand who he was than his own. Gino Williams, Bison and Miles's dad, died in 2006, like I said on part one, after years of substance abuse. So it wasn't that long after his sons both died. To wrap up, what do I think? I don't know whether I believe that this was premeditated. My gut instinct says that it wasn't. And the only thing that could possibly change that is the story about the weightlifting or the gym equipment that they bought and whether there was something weird with that. I don't necessarily believe that Miles was trying to assume his brother's identity like a lot of people, because I actually think at his core he hated his brother. So I don't think he was trying to become him. But I don't actually believe that he turned up to the catamaran with these plans in mind. But while there, I'm sure that, you know, obviously something shifted and then arguments became more and more explosive. And when they were out on that open water in a small confined space, something happened and he just snapped. I believe he'd been jealous of Bison their entire life, which is so sad because he's Bison's older brother and you should always want the best. And you shouldn't be jealous of your siblings. And I think he felt lesser than his whole life. And I think no one ever told him that. I believe it was all in his head, that he was lesser than, and it just built up and up and up and it bubbled up. And he probably intended to do something to Serena. And I really hope that he didn't manage to, but I do think that he just snapped. I believe he probably killed Bison first, because Bison was almost 7 foot tall. It would be, imagine these two men fighting. Imagine the damage to the interior of the catamaran. A 6 foot eight guy, 6 foot 11 guy fighting to the death. It must have taken quite a lot to kind of overpower Bison, which makes me think he may have done it to Bison while he was asleep or something. And I don't really want to think about in what order Serena died, because that opens it up to the fact that she was kept there and something terrible happened before she was finally disposed of too. It was not Bison's responsibility to dumb down his talent to make his brother feel better. It's no one's responsibility, especially not us as women. I see a lot of women dumbing down their intellect, the way they speak, the way they kind of dumb down interests that they have, because they often get told that they're, oh, you're posh, or, oh, she's aloof. You know, if you've got a wide range of interests or you speak well, or even if you've got a university degree, oh, look at you, these kind of backhanded compliments, often from men and often men who feel inferior. And it in this instance with men, there's still that kind of bitterness and that kind of cattiness. But in the end, at the end of the day, it was not for Bison to build up his brother, and it was not for Bison to dumb down his own talent or the achievements that he'd had to make his brother feel better. Miles' trajectory fell entirely on Miles. He was given the same upbringing. He had lots of free money with no strings attached given to him, many chances to start over, and he took none of them. As most people say, he squandered it away on useless stuff and probably scams and things like that. They tend to allude to this kind of stuff. And their lives just went two totally different directions. And I believe that was a little bit down to genetics, but mostly motivation. Both openly suffered from depression. Both openly struggled, although Miles more so with some substance issues. And Miles just couldn't take it because his brother always kind of pulled himself up by his bootstraps. And Miles didn't have that in him. And I'm sure that when he killed Bison, he did it in a really brutal way. He took out 35 or 33 years of hatred for him, on him, which is a terrible thing to think about. But I did say that I would try to cheer you up. So I'm going to end on a funny story that Sam Smith included in another article for ESPN at the time that Bison vanished. Sam Smith, not the singer, Sam Smith, the NBA journalist who knew Bison and covered him quite a lot at the time of his career, but also when he went missing. And he talks about how Bison had this fish tank in his house that was massive, and he used to go snorkeling in it. I'll read you the article for so it makes a bit more sense. But basically, Bison was living in Detroit, and he wasn't used to it. He'd grown up in California and then in Nevada. And in the seasons when it was like cold and snow and there was no sun, Bison just was not accustomed to it. Quote, "So this is what he did. He purchased a gigantic fish tank the size of one wall for his home. He loaded it with all sorts of tropical fish, and then he got himself some snorkeling gear. After practice, Williams would go home and stick his head in the tank and imagine he was snorkeling in the South Pacific. He'd come to practices and tell his teammates about his adventures in his tank and how it took him out of the feeling of being locked in a Midwestern winter," unquote. And that just made me laugh because off the bat of my comment about Absolutely Fabulous on part one, which I was so happy how many people reached out to me and said they love Ab Fab, I'm going to throw out another reference. I was thinking of Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo, the scene with the fish tank. That's all I could think of. but yeah, I hope he enjoyed his snorkeling trip. So I'm just trying to imagine this guy who's almost 6'7" getting home in his jersey, and he immediately puts on a snorkeling mask and puts his head in his massive fish tank, and someone walks in on him. Just trying to imagine that. So, yeah, I don't know how to end it. I hope that Bison and Serena are at peace if that's what happens on the other side. I've put up Bison's episode page. I'll add a few more pictures to it now. I've done part two. It's unknownpassagepodcast.com. Become a patron. It links off the website or search on the Patreon app. Search for Unknown Passage Podcast. There are, I think, four different tiers from $1 a month through to like $20 a month. The most common one, you know, one, two, five a month. Up until five, so $1 and $2 tiers a month, you get a shout out with your name. $5 and over a month from June 1st, as I talked about for months, was you get your Patreon location request. So that's only for $5 and over a month now. For 2 years, I did it for every tier, but I just can't keep up with it anymore. But speaking of Patreon, this was Claire's request for French Polynesia. So thank you, Claire, for requesting this, and I hope that you enjoyed it. Leave a rating or review if you like the show. If you listen on Spotify, go to the Unknown Passage main page and click the stars and leave a 5-star review. That's all. They don't have like ratings or reviews. They just have ratings on it. If you don't want to join, oh, I just went like fucking Irish or Northern English. If you want to give to the podcast, there's a PayPal that just goes towards the website and, you know, sending over money if you appreciate the podcast and the work I put into it. The PayPal is unknownpassagepodcast@gmail.com. I'm not accepting case requests for the foreseeable future through the email. The reason being, I have so many on my list to do. I have about 20 Patreon location requests in the works coming up, and I'm trying my best to keep up with it all. I have about 100 immediate cases that are on my short list that I want to do, and I have 800 on my spreadsheet, and I just can't take on any cases anymore, because unless they're kind of urgent and you someone you know is missing overseas and you want to draw awareness to it, that's one thing. But other than that, if you just want to hear about a case, I just can't take them on at the moment. I'm sorry, guys. You can feel free to send them across and I'll add them to the spreadsheet, but I may not get to it because I've got the next year, 18 months planned out. Next week will be a little bit different, I think. Here's something a little bit different. I've got quite a lot of Patreon location requests coming up. Kevin, Rachel, Valerie, Lisa, Petra, Michelle, Tia, Christine, Simon, Colleen, Tammy, Tracy, Adam, Hannah, Sam, Kylie, Mariana, Elizabeth, Jody, Mark, Rachel, Cheryl, and Richard. And that's doesn't include people who haven't sent their requests yet, so I guess you understand why. When I set up that people can choose a location for any tier, I didn't expect anyone to join Patreon. That's why that happened. And then I had to take time off for surgery, and episodes were less earlier this year when I had my thyroid removed and when I was really sick at the tail end before surgery. So they've kind of like banked up, and then some weeks you'll get like a few people join, and then that's even more on top of the list, like you understand. And then on top of those, interspersed between those, I've got a lot of my own cases that I want to cover as well that will be really interesting. So I will be back then for the next episode. Try to switch off this weekend. Just try to switch off, put your phone in a drawer and go and do something that involves the outside world. Play with an animal, snuggle your pet, pay attention to your kids without looking at your phone, have a conversation with someone without looking at your phone. Just do that. Just do it for half a day, you'll feel better. Believe me. All right, I'll talk to you soon. Bye.